I'm surprised how popular the First World War is. I always tended to work on the theory that it would, like the men who fought it, fade away, but actually it hasn't. And I spend a lot of my working year taking people on battlefield tours. And there's an increasing interest in it. And I think the most striking characteristic about that is that people want to find out more about a grandfather or great uncle. There's a real interest in trying to find out more about the history of one's family, and which goes beyond the commonplace. And people don't simply want to find a grave, and the War Graves Commission has a wonderful computerized search function. So if you know who you're looking for, you can easily find them. But people now, once upon a time, they want to find Great Uncle Edgar's grave, but now they want to find out where he was killed, how he was killed, how he got there, how would he have eaten, got promoted, gone on leave. They want to know more about the social circumstances of his life. And I think this is something which I find actually very healthy. I think people want to know more, not necessarily about arrows on maps, nothing wrong with that, but they want to know more about the social history of the war. I think it's gone beyond battlefield tours, which are sort of mawkish cemetery crawls, which are very easy to do. And I think it's gone more now to battlefield tours, which actually do try to explain, in as much as you ever can, what it was like and what people went through.
So do you think we've almost extended the act of remembrance now, whereas before it was remembering the dead and the casualties, but now it's remembrance is moving into trying to understand what they went through?
I think we've got much better at remembrance. I think remembrance is a very complicated business, and sometimes we remember for political reasons, and I worry about the way that I think we over-memorialise the Western Front by putting on it such a great weight of monuments that sometimes I think its fabric is almost in danger of collapsing beneath the weight of the brick and ashlar that we pile upon it. And sometimes I think we do that for political reasons, because we want to make a particular political point. So in a sense, the points that we're making are not about them at all, they're about us. And that's what some memorials do. But I think at the other extreme, I think we're very properly remembering beyond the 11th of November. We're taking remembrance out of this dark season of poppies and shorter days and longer nights, and looking at it more broadly. And that I applaud. I never know where I am with God or with an afterlife. I try never to say anything or to write anything that I couldn't explain to people who were there at the time. Now, maybe that's an unnecessary and pathetic worry. But I do think if you're a historian, you do have a responsibility not simply to yourself and to the people that you write for, the people whom you talk on television, but you do have a responsibility to the people about whom you're writing. And I often think, when I'm standing in another silent cities, confronted by that crushing weight of Portland stone with names on it, I often think that these men deserve not to be ghettoized on a single day. This isn't just about one day in a year where we stick our poppies in our lapels and go along and look po-faced. I remember them on bright summer days. I remember them when I'm enjoying a glass of port after lunch on Christmas Day, as many of them would. I remember, I mourn, I grieve, but I applaud, and I do it every day of my life.
The November the 11th ceremony obviously is becoming even more important in Britain now. And if you go back to the 70s, it was almost like there was an embarrassment about this event. But even so, my perception is people still think back to the Western Front on November 11th. Obviously the date is symbolic for that war, but there's less of a memory about the Second World War, unless it's something like after 1939, 50 years on, or the Battle of Britain or something like that. Do you believe that to be true, that November 11th still goes back to that first war?
Well, I think it probably does go back to the First War. I think we do remember on November the 11th, in particular the First World War. I don't think we should, actually. I think we should remember just as much the last British soldier killed, it may be yesterday or the day before, by a sniper's bullet or by an improvised explosive device in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, what we're doing is we're remembering anybody who's died for their country. And I think we should remember them and not get fixated by the nature of any particular war. I mean, people like you and I have no real choice if we are in a country which adopts conscription, let's say, in the world wars, as to whether we go or not. I mean, it's something where there are going to be huge social and legal pressures that make us go. And I do feel that my generation, you know, I chose to get myself involved in the military, and it's something I have no regrets about, but it was my decision. And there are quite a lot of people across history. You know, the British Army put nearly 6 million men through its ranks in the First World War. And many of them, half of them were volunteers and half of them were conscripts. These people had no choice. And I think we should commemorate everybody who's worn their country's uniform or risked their life under whatever circumstances. And I extend that act of remembrance right up to include people who moved out last week.
I think where I'm trying to head with this is where you opened. You were talking about your personal experience of going to the Menin Gate when you were a young man, and the tragedy and the pity and the scale of that conflict, which I think is not unique. That's probably what everyone feels. And that when we were talking about Iraq, it's almost the First World War colours the British perception of warfare, I think, across the century, and probably will do for maybe another 100 years.
I think First World War colours our perception of war and our perception of ourselves. I do think there is something very British about that. We remember the way that we remember the First World War. We're inclined to remember the worst bits, not the best bits. There are endless books on the Somme and Passchendaele. Relatively few books on the last 100 days, which, you know, like it or not, was a victorious advance, pushing the Germans right back to Mons in Belgium, where for us the war had started. And these were not Germans who were running away. The Germans, by and large, don't run away. It's something they don't do. These are sturdy machine gun rear guards doing awful damage. And we don't like to remember that because it was successful. We do get drawn. We have a fascination, I think, with the charge of the light brigade syndrome, with gallant but fruitless endeavours. And I think we've got this image of the First World War. I think here is where the influence of poets and First World War literature has not been helpful. And I speak as a historian, touched as I am by the war's poetry, I still think that we do remember it in terms of waste and futility. We remember it in terms of incompetence. I once hoped that by the time I hung up my boots as a historian, by the time I put my computer away and closed it down forever, we'd have come to some sense of balance about the war in history. I don't think it ever will. And we still bounce back with the donkeys theory, that these were lions led by donkeys. And we often lose any sense of complexity. And because we like to believe that the First World War was lions led by donkeys, we then, in subsequent conflicts, are anxious to find silly generals and brave soldiers and dishonest politicians. In other words, the war helps create a sort of list of dramatis personae who are usable for all future conflicts. And I simply don't think it was like that. I think that's what we do with it, but I don't actually think the people who lived in it, that it was anything like that simple.